Good evening, nerd herds. Welcome back to the Perpetual Notion Machine for July 23rd, 2020. On tonight's show, we will be speaking with debunker, skeptic, writer, podcast, skateboard video game progenitor, creator of ContrailScience.com, Metabunk.org, and author of Escaping the Rabbit Hole. It's Mick West, ladies and gentlemen, and friends beyond the binary. Welcome, Mick. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Great to be here.
Awesome.
So, thank you for that very detailed list of of things I've done.
Well, thank you for putting it into Twitter for for the ease of radio hosts worldwide. So the main thesis of the conversation tonight is kind of going to center around not just conspiracy theory, but sort of science denialism, which is a facet of conspiratorial thought. So in the world of the pandemic, I guess the post-pandemic, the meta-pandemic world that we live in now, we're dealing with a lot of complicated science topics that people might not necessarily completely understand or not understand how they're relevant to them. Immunology is in the news, and whenever immunology is in the news, that's usually a bad thing because it's terribly complicated. So I guess one of the main questions that I kind of want to talk around tonight is there are people who just cannot imagine why someone would leave their house without wearing a mask for safety's sake. And for compassion's sake too. You know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why people would wear masks as recommended by the CDC to prevent the transmission of the coronavirus. But for just as many reasons, there are people out there who cannot imagine why someone would go along with this. So how can we kind of ameliorate these two really opposing views and sort of bring our society together? So, yeah.
That is a big question to start with. I think the key thing there with that topic is that people get their information from very different information sources. And we know that in the mainstream media, we have a spectrum of sources from just in the middle, really. We have things like MSNBC on one side and Fox News on the other side. But there are also sources like to either side of those on the spectrum of sources, which are more extreme. Like if you go further left, you have things like Occupy Democrat. And if you have you go further right, you have things like Breitbart. And then there are other sources that people of information that people get their information about these topics from, which are in some ways not even on the spectrum. They're just completely off to the top or the bottom of the spectrum and off way off to one side. So when you think you can't understand why people believe something completely different to you, like you really want to kind of maybe step out of your own bubble, not you personally, but whoever.
Me personally, because that is one of the problems too. Is I think that there are people that think like I'm right. I don't need to step out of my bubble, and that kind of is that's the cycle.
Yeah, and the thing is, like, if you only listen to one set of information sources, you're just getting information that reinforces your set of beliefs. So it makes you feel more and more and more that you are right, and that makes you think more and more and more that this information source is the correct one, and so you just get stuck. You get into a rabbit hole. If you only watch, say, MSNBC, you get in a fairly narrow range of views, you know, which may or may not be correct. I'm more of an MSNBC watcher than I am a Fox News watcher, but I do watch both of them. But if you've never watched Fox News and you go there and you start watching it, it's quite incredible what the difference is. Likewise, if you've watched Fox News for the last few years and you think that they are telling you the truth about everything, and then you step away from them and you start watching the other side, like MSNBC or CNN, or even something, you know, slightly more neutral, like perhaps the BBC News, it's very, very different. And but now we're getting into a situation where one side is often describing the other side as being fake news. And this happens, again, in both directions. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, which side is more fake than the other, but both sides describe the other side as being fake news. And so both sides perceive people on the other side as being tricked. We think that all the people who watch Fox News have been tricked into believing that, you know, the virus is a Democrat hoax, that the response to the virus is a Democrat hoax, or whatever it is. And likewise, the people who watch the other side, you know, think the exact opposite. So people think that you have been tricked. So when you're talking to somebody who you think, yeah, how can you possibly believe this? They are thinking and quite possibly saying the exact same thing to you. Mm-hmm. And in order to get past that, we've got to actually try to understand why this person can believe it. We can't just stop at incredulity. I mean, sure, it seems incredible that these people don't believe these things, but it also seems incredible to them that we don't believe how they believe. So we need to both explain to them why we believe what we believe and try to get them to explain to us why they believe what they believe. And by doing that, it creates a basis of a conversation that you can actually use to work out these differences and move forward on both sides.
Yeah, so I think, so you and I both have this problem, I think, a lot. As a research scientist, I'm unfortunately put in a position of being kind of a killjoy for certain things. And it's pretty unenviable. That's being someone who tells somebody that they're wrong is not usually gratifying, for anybody. So how do you approach this conversation? You know, what is your usual approach to talking to somebody once you've realized that there's a potentially dangerous conflict of interest between the two?
Well, I think normally people's first reaction in such a situation is the wrong one, to kind of leap in and explain to someone why they're wrong. Unless you're very good at explaining to people why they're wrong, you'll generally do it badly. You'll just present the cold, hard facts as you see them. And if they make some claim, they say, for example, that masks trap carbon dioxide. In you, and you know, you say no, that is false, because carbon dioxide molecules are so small that they just go through the mesh of the mask, which is 0.1 microns, which is way bigger than a molecule. Yeah, that approach, for one thing, it's, you know, if your tone of voice might be wrong for a start, you might be a little bit dismissive of what they're saying. This is just me talking. Mm-hmm. But what you've done is kind of spewed out a bunch of simple science, but it's science that they're probably not going to really understand. Mm-hmm. And you've basically just created an argument from your own self-authority, and you've just dismissed, you've just basically said, no, it's not. You've just rejected it in almost what seems to them a childish way. Like you've just negated what they have heard their authorities telling them. They've got all these people, all these different people, like, saying these things. They've read it in multiple different places. Their friends have told them this. They agree with this. To them, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. So for them, it's like this accepted knowledge that's well supported by, you know, whatever they think of as being science. And then you come along and you just try to bat it down. So you're kind of, in a way, starting in the wrong place if you start out trying to just debunk their claims straight away in a conversation. And it might be better not even to talk about that claim straight away.
Sure.
Maybe start talking about where they heard about that. You know, where did they get their information? Mm-hmm. Try to figure out why they believe it. And you don't have to start away by questioning it. Like, yeah, that's ridiculous. Where did you hear that? You can say, that's interesting. Like, you know, where do you hear that about carbon dioxide? And why would it trap carbon dioxide? And then you could maybe just do a little bit more kind of Socratic dialogue type things and say, well, you know, doctors wear masks in the operating theater for a very long time, and you know, they don't seem to have any oxygen deficiency or carbon dioxide overload. So what's going on there? And you just get them to think mm-hmm. about it. You don't need to actually say, you know, this proves that it is false. You just kind of lead the conversation along and try to get them to actually think about it. Mm-hmm. Because if you give these definitive things to them, then they're kind of forced to either accept them or reject them. Whereas if you just pose questions, which are still essentially, you know, giving them the same information or lead them towards the same information, the same factual information. And it's very important that you do this very, very honestly with stuff that is actually true, and you don't try to trick them in some way, you know, obviously.
Right.
But, if you're leading them towards this information and they can kind of come to a realization for themselves, it works a lot better than you kind of just trying to hammer it through to them.
Yeah. So in your podcast, Tales from the Rabbit Hole, which is in many ways a reflection of your book, you do such an amazing job talking to people, talking through this. The conversations are very warm. It sounds like a conversation between old friends. So I know, yeah, so there's a lot of work that needs to go into these relationships, obviously, but it is very, very possible to help pull people out.
Yeah, it definitely is. And I say my book is about how to help friends, families, and loved ones out of the rabbit hole of conspiracy thinking. And throughout the book, I refer to the person you're talking to as your friend, mm-hmm. Which is kind of just a convenient term to use because other people use terms like interlocutor, which is a very complex word that no one understands,
or
your opponent, or your debate partner, or things like that. There's words that kind of conjure up. They don't understand what the words are, but saying what your friend is just a person that you're chatting to. Mm-hmm. And even if they're not particularly your friend, it helps to think of them as your friend. It helps mm-hmm. to have a friendly way of talking to them, even if you think they're insufferable assholes. It is still better to treat them as nice people. And perhaps they're not as bad as you think they are. Perhaps they just come across very, very gruff to start off with. A lot of people, when they first start talking to me, they start out kind of angry.
Mm-hmm.
Because they think they've heard things about me. They say Mick West is a debunker, is a government shill. He's just pushing the government story on everything. He believes everything the government tells him. And so they start out angry. So they'll say, "Why are you doing this? Why are you trying to like change people's minds when you don't believe it yourself? Why do you trust everything the government says?" And then I start out, I tell them I don't trust everything the government says. I think that there's lots and lots of corruption in mm-hmm. in power. Politician is kind of synonymous with corruption, or at least somewhat dishonest dealings, not entirely having the public's best interests at heart, and deception, things like that. So it's very obvious that there's lots of corruption going on in government and all levels of government, and I don't trust everything the government tells me. And then when you kind of tell them that and perhaps give them a few examples. The example I always kind of talk about is one of my pet peeves about the United States, which is the prison population, which, mm-hmm. as you know, is one of the largest, if not the largest per capita prison populations in the entire world. I think just perhaps Somalia or some place like that is a slightly higher thing. But, there's 3 million Americans either in jail or in prison or being held against their will at some type of institution. 3 million people, it's quite incredible. It's vastly higher than other countries. Kind of getting off on that tangent, but I would do that. I would talk about this particular thing that I think is very, very wrong with the American political system. And then you can talk a bit about the military industrial complex and how much military money there is in government, and how much foreign policy is influenced by whether to build a particular military factory in some congressman's home state, things like that, things that are actual real world problems that are very, very significant and are not to do with trusting the government. So you can talk about these things with people. And it might seem like you're not addressing the central issue of why should they wear a mask or not? Mm. But the reason they're not wearing a mask is in part because they have this distrust of government, and they think that the people in power, the deep state or whoever, have kind of conjured up this coronavirus as some kind of plot to unseat Donald Trump or something like that. I'm sure it varies by individual.
So do you see conspiracy thought as inherently anti-science?
That's a difficult question, because if you look at Flat Earth, for example, one of the most extremely unscientific conspiracy theories out there, the people who believe in Flat Earth think they are doing science.
Mm-hmm.
They think they have got the science right. So they're not really anti-science in the way that they think that all science is false. If they find science that they agree with, they will quote you on it. But they are anti-science in the sense that they view science as you know, an ivory tower institution. And this is kind of a lot of what goes on in conspiracy theories, is that they won't trust, you know, simple scientists. Not that scientists are simple, but, you know, just scientists qua scientists.
Well, that's another thing too that I don't think that people necessarily understand. If you go on a professor's website and you get their email and you write them an email, there's a really good chance that they'll respond to you. They're people and they love to talk about science, so they're not as unapproachable, I think, as people. And everyone listening out there, email your favorite scientist, ask them a question. We love it.
Yeah, this is true. One of the scientists I had on my podcast, David Keith, who's like one of the world's leading experts on geoengineering, which is this thing that's, you know, might be done in the future to alter the world's climate by spraying things in the atmosphere to alter the Earth's albedo, which, you know, something we probably don't want to do because of all the possible unforeseen consequences, but some scientists think that we might be forced to do it. But there's a conspiracy theory around that, that it's already been done, and that it's been done for decades, and that what we see as in the air as contrails are actually chemtrails, which are secretly doing this geoengineering. And David Keith is kind of the face of the beast, in a way, for the conspiracy theorists. He's the guy that they all think is in charge of this project, even though they haven't really even done any practical experiments in geoengineering yet. He's been trying to get permission to spray 2 kilograms of water, I think, in the air from a balloon for years. And that's about as far as things has progressed. But, you know, they think there's been this secret plot. But I talked to him, and he said that if people wanted to know what he's doing, they could actually go to his office.
Yeah.
He didn't even say, like, you know, phone me or drop me an email. He said, come to my office. Talk to my research students who are in the office and ask them what goes on in this office, and they will tell you.
Yeah.
So that he's perfectly approachable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, and that's a great point too. I think that for as much as there's a gestalt that is anti-science as an institution, there are people that are very rah-rah science as an institution that aren't necessarily scientists. And I think that it's problematic to promote science as a monolith in any capacity, because I think anybody that does science, I mean, the first thing you do is shred your ego. You know, you accept that you don't know everything. We're very comfortable with ambiguity, with not knowing for sure, with not proving things, with just sort of gathering evidence. So I think that, and that's another problem too, when you talk to somebody who has such convicted beliefs, is that if you run into the right scientist on the right day, I mean, you can just push them over. I mean, you're not necessarily going to convert them, but, you know, I mean, I think that a lot of us are willing to say, yeah, we don't know. That's possible, but there's no data, there's no evidence for it. So I'll withhold judgment until, you know, something pops up. And generally, you know, the threshold for a scientist's data requirement is a little bit higher given that. But yeah, I think that, again, like you said, bringing people to the table is just so important. And I want people to engage more with scientists in any way that they can.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and there's, you know, like what you're talking about there with scientists. Sometimes scientists get asked opinions on topics like conspiracy theories, and the answers that they give always seem to support the conspiracy theory because they don't know very much about it. So they're like, oh, that's interesting. That's possible. Yeah, that might happen. Because you just presented them with this novel, interesting hypothesis that, you know, they think should be investigated. But that often you get conspiracy theorists will seize upon any little grass, any little little fragment of authority that they can get, and they will take that and they will run with it. Even though, like, the vast majority of science is arrayed against them. I was involved in a study that we did with another geoengineering professor, Ken Caldera, and it was basically canvassing atmospheric scientists and presenting them with the evidence for the chemtrail theory, which was basically these photographs of contrails and some various tests that have been done of the water, and like then asking them, does this evidence indicate a secret large-scale spraying program? And we had a lot of trouble finding scientists who would participate in the study because a lot of them were just like, so ridiculous. I'm not even going to bother with that. Chemtrails? Why are you even doing this? But we did actually get like 70 bona fide scientists to participate. And all of them said, this is not evidence of a large-scale spraying program. except for one guy who said this, it mostly wasn't, except for maybe this one thing where there was a little bit of elevated barium in one sample. Maybe that was evidence of thing. And so we presented this, and then the media was like, yeah, chemtrails debunked, everything. But the chemtrail people were like, yeah, this scientist thinks that chemtrails are real.
So maybe we shouldn't put the scientists up front.
You have to ask them. I mean, you don't want to obviously manipulate the study, but you also don't want to like phrase it in such a way that it can be misinterpreted.
You're leading the witness at some point. Yeah. So I'm curious to know, how does conspiracy theory start? How does it grow? How does it senesce? How does it die? What is kind of the life cycle of a conspiracy?
Well, conspiracy theory is an explanation for something. So they start usually with a significant event. There's kind of two types of conspiracy theories. There's ones that explain events, and there's ones that explain situations. Like you could say, you know, why is the world the way it is now with bankers, having all the money? Or you could say, you know, why did 9/11 happen, or why did the coronavirus happen? So a lot of times people are seeking an explanation for something. And the explanations that are given, the official explanations, are often unsatisfying, in part because they are disproportionate to the actual events that happened. You think of JFK being the prime example there. JFK was assassinated, huge event, but it was just, you know, one lone guy with a gun. That explanation doesn't sound very satisfying, so a lot of people think that it must be part of some larger plot. And so they start trying to figure out what that explanation might be. And they think of it as investigating, but in a way it's really kind of creating a narrative. It's really kind of storytelling. And you're creating a story that you think fits the what you see as the fact. So you're trying to come up with a narrative. And this is how the conspiracy theory starts, is that someone is trying to figure out the explanation. And then it spreads by people telling each other these things and by people promoting them in some way, like either printing them back in the olden days or putting them on the internet. And now, more than ever, making YouTube videos or some kind of video and putting the narrative, the story out there in a palatable format, a very tasty format that people can consume very easily. And then people get hooked. People see these nice, well-packaged videos, and they think that sounds very reasonable. And then YouTube will show them another well-packaged video, and they'll start watching that, and so it goes.
So do you think that the angry man yelling in a truck trope would work for scientists? Is that a better way for us to communicate science?
You want scientists to to yell in a truck?
Yeah, sure. That seems to be on the old suggested watching list more often than I'd like to see it. So maybe they got something.
Well, entertainment is what people are looking for, and so if you can present science in an entertaining way, without degrading the actual science, the actual content that's in there. You know, there's lots of good science communicators out there. There's quite a few good science channels, but in a way they're preaching to the choir.
Right.
And the people who are interested in science, like you and me, will watch these kind of very nerdy science channels and get excited when a new episode appears. But often these science channels are not really addressing the topics that conspiracy theorists do. And when they do address them, like, for example, with the 5G coronavirus type thing, or, the mask wearing science stuff, or the plandemic stuff, it's often in a perhaps a bit too superficial a way, even though they're basically giving the correct explanation for things. Mm-hmm. It doesn't come with a sufficiently interesting narrative to get into the conspiracy theorist's brain. But they prefer this detailed story that they have of this big evil conspiracy. And then here comes a scientist who just says, no, that's not true at all. And, you know, we wear masks in the operating theater, so it's not a problem. So I think a scientist kind of need to focus a little bit more on making their explanations both relevant to the conspiracy theorists and making them consumable in the same way that these conspiracy theory videos are consumable.
So I just had a couple more questions I wanted to get to. Unfortunately, we only have half an hour for the show. So we also wanted to touch on how does access to information sort of modulate the acceptance of science versus conspiratorial thinking and narratives?
Well, that's an interesting question. Access to information. Everybody has the same access to information. Pretty much nowadays, no one's really, we can't all get to the scientific journals, but no one's going to read those anyway. But we all have the same access to information. It's really, how do we get people to look at things outside of their little walled gardens? And I think, that's something we need to focus on. I think really the social media companies could be doing more with actually pushing content that is outside of what people want to watch, rather than just things that are inside the walls of what they're used to watching.
Let's see. Yeah, the other thing that we were kind of talking about before the show started too is, especially for scientists, we have this sort of knee-jerk reaction where we think that if somebody doesn't believe a scientific fact, it's because they don't have the information. So we'll bend over backwards to try to give them facts and figures as best we know how, but a lot of times it's not a convincing enough way to go about. And in fact, there's scientific studies coming out now that demonstrate that this is actually counterproductive, that you come off as we'd said, kind of talking down to people.
Yeah.
So this idea of the narrative seems to be so important in not just conspiratorial thought, but something that science kind of needs to grapple with as well, is how the scientific narrative sort of shapes popular culture.
Yeah, you got to think of how does this scientific fact fit in the worldview. You can't just view facts in isolation. You got to think, how does this actually relate to things? And if you want to communicate something to somebody, it's obviously best to put it in terms that they can understand, like some practical explanation or some kind of even a practical demonstration or at least some kind of practical way of communicating about it. A lot of times things are come across as being very isolated and too abstract. So putting it in a more, not necessarily entertaining, but certainly more tailored way to the individual. Maybe this is something that needs to happen a little bit more. And maybe this is something that artificial intelligence could help with in the future. Instead of having just one way of communicating the facts to everybody, like a book or whatever, everybody gets something that's actually tailored by artificial intelligence to their own knowledge set. And so it actually slots into their worldview more easily.
So you have a book coming out that is kind of approaching this topic, correct?
I wouldn't say it's coming out because I haven't just started working on it, but it will come out probably next year sometime, which is about the science of science of conspiracy theories. And it's interesting in itself, just what is the science of things like contrails and chemtrails, but also why don't people understand when you talk to them about why a contrail is just a cloud? There's all kinds of complicated things there that even people who try to explain it from a scientific point of view end up missing. Things like the flat Earth, why does a rocket work in a vacuum? We can talk about, there's thrust vectors, one thing goes this way, one thing goes the other way, but why does that even happen? When it comes down to it, it's about the molecules bouncing off the inside surfaces of the rocket. It's not really so much about an arrow going this way and an arrow going that way. It's much more complicated than that. How do you communicate things when they don't really understand the simple explanation and the real explanation is even more complicated?
Oh, that is the question, isn't it? I can't grapple with that every day. Well, we are running a little low on time. I did want to run one quick question by you. As somebody who is obviously an enthusiast of conspiracy and science fiction and these kinds of thoughts, what is your favorite conspiracy? What is one that you kind of makes you chuckle?
I think my favorite one is the Flat Earth one. Not so much that it makes me chuckle. It's really because it presents so many opportunities for doing fun science. I've actually done more practical science with the Flat Earth theory than I have with pretty much any of the other theories that I work with, because you can go out and you can do observations of things like the ocean horizon, and you can do things like watch ships go below the horizon, or you can go and see what does this island look like from the beach versus from a mountain. If there's an island 40 miles away across the ocean, you can take photos and you can make videos, you can do 3D recreations. I've done experiments with lasers in my garage, like showing why light refracts towards cold air and away from hot air. And you know, it's just a real fun topic to get your teeth into, and it's something they might even want to teach in schools. Not teach the theory itself, but teach why it's wrong and how we know it's wrong.
And that's a great way to end the show, this idea that you can use science to answer a lot of different questions in a lot of different ways, and the goal is to bring people together to come to common solutions.
Indeed.
Thank you very much. Mick West has been our guest tonight. You have been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine.